The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of March 27th, 2017. On this week's show, we'll talk about the Final Four of South Carolina, North Carolina, Gonzaga, and Oregon, the buzzer beater that got UNC past Kentucky, and the accumulation of texts on Florida guard Chris Chioza's phone. We'll also discuss the U.S. women's hockey team's move to boycott the upcoming World Championships as part of a fight for an increase in wages and benefits, and the U.S. Hockey Federation's failed attempt to get high school players to compete in their place. And Slate's Ben Mathis-Lilly will join us for a conversation about his story on Fox Sports One. It's home of the likes of Skip Bayless, Colin Cowherd, and Jason Whitlock. And it's a network that's betting on winning viewers by providing sports fans with every possible opinion and its exact opposite. Joining me in Washington, D.C. is Stefan Fatsis, author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic, and a man who finished tied for first place in Pesca Jeopardy with $0. Hello, Stefan.
Hey, Josh. I was very proud of that. I did well.
With us here in our D.C. studio, also tied for the lead in Pesca Jeopardy with $0, it's Jane Costin. She's a politics writer with MTV, a graduate of the University of Michigan, and someone who inquired on Twitter 2 weeks before Jim Harbaugh was hired as Michigan's football coach, has anyone been driven to murder by a college football coaching search? Just wondering for a friend. Did you ever find the answer?
Fortunately not. Everyone in that college, that search came dangerously close to some places we shouldn't go. Like, we went to the great beyond, and we came back, apparently.
We're going to talk about Jim Harbaugh later. I'm going to find a way to smuggle him into this week's podcast. We launched a survey last week, and we got a lot of responses. I was surprised by how many.
Maybe a lot of good responses.
Go to slate.com/survey. We still retain the rights to that URL. No other Slate surveys have come into existence in the last week. And let us know what you think about the show and what you'd like us to do with the show. In our bonus segment for Slate Plus members this week, we're going to talk about the continued unemployment of erstwhile 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick and how much that unemployment has to do with his refusal even to stand for the national anthem during the NFL season just passed. Join Slate Plus to find out the answer to this and other burning questions. It's just $49 a year, and you'll get bonus segments on this and other Slate podcasts every week. Sign up at slate.com/hangup+. On Sunday night in Memphis, it took Kentucky and North Carolina 39 minutes and 59.7 seconds to decide which team would join Gonzaga, Oregon, and South Carolina in the Final Four. In the closing moments, UNC was up 3 with Justin Jackson at the free throw line for 1-1. Here is how the rest of the game sounded, courtesy of Gary Cohen on Westwood One Radio, because I like him and I don't like Jim Nantz. Gary Cohen, take it away.
North Carolina up 3, 14.7. The first one off the back rim, no good. Rebound Fox, 13 seconds. Here comes Briscoe. Briscoe veering right, hands off to Monk, turns, fires the 3. Good! The game is tied, 7 seconds to go. Here comes Pinson down the center of the floor. Pinson penetrates, hands to May, 18-footer. Good! With 3/10 of a second to go, North Carolina leads. Luke May from just inside the left arc.
So that was awesome. A few days earlier, Wisconsin's Zach Showalter and Florida's Chris Chioza had exchanged nearly identical leaping-leaning three-pointers to send their Sweet 16 game into overtime and to win at the buzzer, respectively. After the game, Chioza showed reporters his phone, and he'd received more texts in the 3 minutes after his shot went in than I think I've received collectively in my entire lifetime. And that led me to wonder if there's anything I could ever do to get everyone I know to text me at exactly the same time. And the answer I came up with was probably nothing that did not involve a helicopter chase.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'd say so. Like, I think at this point, it's either sports or you'd have to have, like, do you remember when those llamas ran away? You'd have to be one of the llamas.
I do remember when the llamas ran away. Josh says you're a little llama-like.
I can see that. Like, happening. If you and a llama just went sprinting off into the distance, then a lot of people would text you.
So I have a lot of projects to work on this week. That's one of them. I like that idea. The Chioza and Showalter buzzer beaters, I thought, were better It was almost like hilariously similar to the buzzer beater that you shoot growing up in the proverbial driveway. Like, I had never seen a buzzer beater that was like such the platonic ideal of a buzzer beater.
Right.
As this.
I think also because Showalter was falling down at the time. Like, there were like 3 seconds left. His defender was on top of him, and he somehow managed, while falling forward, to hit a buzzer beater, which I think that that's the moment where you realize, like, oh, these kids have practiced this exact scenario so many times. And I think that that's – there are many times where you're like, oh, these are college kids. And I think that's one. And I think Kennedy Meeks screwing up the inbounds pass like 3 times, which that was the moment where I was like, oh, this is what I would do. Like, this is exactly how I would handle the situation, is to not be able to do it at all and fail.
And the Chiozza one, though, was platonic because it was so perfect.
Right.
He took off from behind the three-point line and he shot it. He basically could have dunked it. I mean, he was that close, it seemed, to the basket after he took off. But he was
– one of the classic from behind the three-point line dunks that,
yeah.
we've never seen
a three-point dunk, have we?
And it's funny because I remember saying on Twitter right after that, like, there really isn't anything Wisconsin could have done, because if you foul on a three-point attempt
– that's what Jane Costin would have done. So hard.
I think that – Wisconsin would have set itself on fire. Like, I honestly think that that ending is as good as it could have possibly been for both sides in terms of just, like, what could have resulted. Because I honestly, like, Nigel Hayes was on him, and it was, like, keeping his hands up, and there's nothing to do.
I mean, the parallel with the end of the UNC-Kentucky game was very similar to the end of the championship game last year, too. A screen set up, a drop-off pass, and a shot that goes in. I mean, that was terrifically exciting and well executed. I mean, it looks like chaos with 7 seconds to go, but clearly from what Roy Williams, the UNC coach, said after the game and what the players said, too, this is something that they prepare for. I mean, this is exactly the kind of play that they are aware of. They're aware of space. They're aware of where their teammate's going to be, and their teammate is aware of where he needs to be in order to receive a pass to take a shot like that.
And also the fact that Luke May had the presence of mind to just not think about it. And he was saying afterwards, like, you know, I like that
presence of mind not to think.
Mm-hmm. That's, I think, the essential of playing high-level sports.
It was mindless thinking.
Yeah, you just, whatever, just turn it off. Because I think that that's the thing you see, I was talking to my spouse about this, that, like, that's why the beginning of any Super Bowl or the beginning of any title game is so bad, because everyone is thinking so hard. And so you saw that even in this UNC-Kentucky game, where, like, the first 10 minutes, you're just like, guys, stop it. Just stop it.
So those two teams played during the regular season, and Marcus Monk scored 47, one of the best college performances in my recent memory, at least. And in this game, Monk didn't do very much at all until making those two crazy threes in the last minute. I think you're right. It's because he really had no other choice and stopped thinking, and his amazing skill kicked in. But it was a little disappointing. Stefan, you mentioned before we went on the air that you were sad that Kentucky didn't win, that Fox and Monk have been so great during the tournament and really all year, and that, you know, Fox got 2 fouls in the first half, barely played, like, that those guys just did not really
and
show
Calipari
how good they are.
And John Calipari, the Kentucky coach, complained about it after the game that, you know, my players were getting, you know, he was not getting the calls. He was complaining about the reffing. You know, and I hope this doesn't, but it will, reignite the what is a basketball program conversation. UNC doesn't do one and dones. Calipari has had 18 players spend one season with Kentucky before going to the NBA since 2009 when Calipari got there. UNC, no one-and-done players since Brandon Wright in 2007. That was the first year that the NBA got rid of the high school players going straight to the league. Yeah. They started 2 seniors and 3 juniors, UNC did this year. They all played in the championship game last year. And they talk a lot about, you know, we are a program. And Roy Williams talks about how he wants players to come and feel like it is home and create a community, which, of course, is largely bullshit because of what the NCAA does and how it restricts these athletes from gaining benefits from playing college basketball. I saw a guy tweeted last night, a local reporter in Carolina, apparently talked to Theo Pinson of the Tar Heels after the game, and Pinson apparently said, "Hell of a game. We made a lot of money for the NCAA today."
That's awesome. And he had the winning assist.
Yeah.
And the best quote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think everyone's gotten so used to the one-and-done rule, especially when you start thinking about players who should technically still be in college or would technically still be in college, and how when it comes to UNC, like I was like, Kennedy Meeks has been there for just generations. And I'm like, oh, no.
I wanted to play this clip for you guys and get your thoughts. De'Aaron Fox, after the game, responding to the allegation, I mean, according to him, at least proffered by many, that Kentucky's freshman one-and-done players didn't really care about the outcome of the season because they were going straight to the NBA.
It was tough. You know, we had a hell of a season. You know, we went through that stretch and we lost those games, and everybody talked about, you know, how we looked like we didn't care. And, you know, this isn't the locker room that looked like the guys don't care. I love my brothers, man.
So that was kind of hard to watch, but it's exactly why we love the NCAA tournament, or right. One of the reasons. Mm-hmm. Jane, you were watching the game last night, Mississippi State and Baylor, and the women's tournament where Morgan William scored 41 points. It was on the anniversary of her father's death, and it was incredibly emotional to see that performance in her interview afterwards.
Like, she could not speak. All she kept saying was, like, this is for my dad. And it's one of those moments where I think that I love the NCAA tournament on both sides, because it really introduces the vagaries of reality, where a lot of times if you're watching like a really good NBA team or a really good NBA game, I think you saw that during like the NBA finals last year, where you're just like, these are not human beings. Like, you see the emotions of humans, but not quite the actions of humans. And then a lot of times when you're watching the NCAA tournament, like, you see people screw up really obviously. Like, you see someone like, you know, you see a game get settled it was UNC Arkansas, where there was like a what should have been a travel but wasn't a travel, wasn't called or something like that. But you just see like humanness and reality intervening in a way that you don't really see in professional sports. And I thought that, like, for those of you who had a chance to watch, the Mississippi State Baylor game last night was ridiculous. It went into overtime. You know, Morgan William is 5'5". She's her point guard. I think she'd had, earlier in the tournament, she'd had like 11 points combined and then just went off yesterday.
Well, the thing that I thought of watching Fox and then watching Morgan William, the interview after that game, was that it was exploitative, but not in the way that the NCAA is exploitative. It was exploitative in the way that television is exploitative, in the way at the end of all these games, they linger on the shots of the losing team crying. And I guess in this case with Morgan William, on the you know, the winning player crying. And it's a television show. And that, I think, drives home for me more the injustice of these players not getting compensated, because they're the stars of a multi-billion dollar TV show that we all love to watch.
And I think that part of that is also because if you're a fan of Kentucky or UNC or a lot of college basketball programs, you are probably a much bigger fan of that than you are of any NBA program. And you treat those players in your head kind of like they are NBA-level players. And so, you know, I would never want to get into the mentions or something like that of any, like, you know, Chris Chioza, like, or any of these players. I would never want to just be like, I would never want to be them on the internet, because people treat them like they are NBA players. Or like, you know, those Kentucky players are probably getting from the Big Blue Nation, like, they are probably getting so much backlash because they lost a game. And yet, because I think that they're lifted up to this level where they're expected to be like NBA players, but they're not. And they don't have that level of responsibility. And like you said, they're not compensated for this. They're doing this because they eventually want to be compensated, but right now they're doing this in effect for sort of free.
All right. Any thoughts on South Carolina, Oregon, besides the fact that they have an old guy playing for them?
So I like this time of year because it forces me to sort of reconcile how these programs are assembled and take a little bit closer look. And Gonzaga is really interesting. I mean, Mark Few, Gonzaga's made the tournament, what, 19 years in a row now? Mark Few's been there since 1999. The way he's assembled this team is different, though. A lot of transfers from high-profile programs. And as you start to read the backstories on the players and how they ended up there, you again realize, like, the inequities that are baked into the NCAA system. I mean, Nigel Williams-Goss left the University of Washington because there was tremendous turnover on the staff and players leaving left and right. Jonathan Williams left Missouri because the coaches who recruited him split and he didn't like the new coach. He stuck it out for 1 year. And then when he decided to transfer, Missouri wouldn't let him transfer to any SEC or Big 12 school, plus Arizona and Illinois, 26 schools in all. And I'm getting this information. I read a terrific story in the student newspaper, the Gonzaga Bulletin, where they talked to the players about their transfer situations. Mark Few recognized sort of the inefficiencies in the system. He brings in transfers. He recruits overseas. There are players from Japan, Denmark, Poland on this roster. It's how do you succeed in a system where North Carolina has four McDonald's All-Americans on its roster and Gonzaga has had four in the history of its program, three of them transfers.
Right. And I think it's going to be interesting because it's a Final Four with three first-time coaches making it and then three programs who, you know, Oregon won the national championship in 1939 and that's the last thing they did. They beat Ohio State when they were wandering Webfoots, which I think they should go back to. But you've got these three programs and North Carolina. And so I think I was talking about this yesterday, but I think that if you're a North Carolina fan, you kind of see that Elite Eight game as being your national title game. Like that's like if you did that, then you can come into this Final Four, especially because they're going to play Oregon, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's someone was talking about this online that like if you're a CBS executive, if it somehow turns into a South Carolina Oregon national championship game, you're just gonna like wander into the sea. Now, I disagree because I think that sounds awesome. Both teams, Oregon has been tremendous, and I say that as a Michigan fan who basically I spent the entire time the entire weekend being like, well, by the transitive property, that means we're about 10 points better than Kansas. But I think that it's really cool to have. I think a lot of people think that, the Blue Bloods will attract more viewers. But honestly, I think my national championship was like UCLA, UCLA, Kansas or something like that. And I'm like, actually, I don't really want to watch that. Like that sounds – I don't want to watch Lonzo Ball do anything.
It's hard to disagree. But let's move on.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The 2017 Ice Hockey Women's World Championship is set to begin in Plymouth, Michigan later this week. And as of this moment, the three-time defending world champions from the United States are not planning to be there. So we're recording this on Monday morning. There is a vote by the USA Hockey Board of Directors that is happening on Monday. So by the time you hear this, the conditions on the ground may have changed. But here's the backstory. A couple weeks ago, the captain of the team, Megan Duggan, said in a statement that she and her teammates were asking for a living wage and for USA Hockey to fully support its programs for women and girls and stop treating us like an afterthought. Her teammate, Jocelyn Lamoureux Davidson, said this was the culmination of trying to negotiate for 14 months and getting nowhere. Going public has been a pretty brilliant strategic move by USA Women's Hockey. They've gotten support from the players' unions of essentially every other sport in existence. And the message has been received by, I think, also pretty much every woman who plays hockey in the United States because the Federation has tried to recruit down to the high school level players to take the place of the national team at the World Championships. And I think they've gotten not a single person to say that they would play in the championship.
Yeah. And it's been, they're not really doing a great job right now, especially when it's getting to the point that people have been joking that, like, you know, I played rec league like 3 years ago and I'm expecting to get an email pretty soon just being like, so are you busy then? No, it's
we scouted you.
Yeah. And it's interesting also because I think part of the impetus here is because USA women's hockey has been so good for so long. And I think it's a similar
three straight world championships.
Exactly. And it's a similar situation to the, and I think that's why you're seeing so much support coming from the US women's national soccer team, is because they're in a similar situation of just being massively better than their male counterparts, but not receiving the compensation is nowhere near equal. And just the level of just respect that they're getting from their own kind of organization is just minimal.
I was stunned by one fact, which was that in the 6 months leading up to the Olympics, they get $1,000 a month. That's how much the players on the women's national ice hockey team have been paid. I mean, that's outrageous. And so, yes, going public was a tremendously smart idea. But what is really interesting to me is how this has coalesced into something much bigger than women's ice hockey, which for all of the success of the U.S. women and their Canadian counterparts, who are by far and away the two best teams in the world, this is not a sport that has had the kind of recognition or attention or generated the kind of revenue or TV audiences that the women's national soccer team has for the last 20 years. So for this to be the fulcrum for a movement is kind of amazing. To have the National Hockey League Players Association, the National Football League Players Association, Major League Baseball Players Association come out in support of these women, to me suggests that this is a turning point in the way that the public and prominent athletes choose to support each other in terms of fighting for better rights for women's athletes.
So the counterargument here, as always, is the idea that women's hockey, the U.S. women's hockey, doesn't generate revenue, doesn't generate the revenue that the men's game does. But if you look at the CNN Money had a story about the different perks offered, and at the World Championships, the men are like allowed to bring guests and the women are not allowed to bring guests. Mm-hmm. And so even if you're going to take the most hardline view that says, I don't believe in equal pay because it should just be strictly about how much money you generate, capitalism raw. It's like there's fairness issue that goes far beyond money.
And it's not even the fairness issue in terms of perks for the players at the highest level. I mean, I made this argument when we discussed the U.S. women's soccer team's dispute over their contract. USA Hockey is a governing body for this sport in the United States. It is a nonprofit.
Not for men's hockey.
The goal of USA Hockey is to develop the sport, not men's hockey, not women's hockey. I argued in women's soccer, given their participation numbers and their success and the fan interest and how much more money the men make professionally than the women in soccer, an even split is not unreasonable. The idea here is to lift everybody up, to make the United States a better hockey country, to make the United States a better soccer country. You could argue that you should spend more on women's ice hockey because it has been so underserved for so long compared to men's hockey. USA Hockey has a men's development program. It's called high school hockey and peewee hockey and college hockey and an established minor league hockey system.
Right. And I think that, you know, I really agree with that point, because if the, you know, when you see the numbers, especially with how not just programming for women at this level, but the program for girls, where at the point, like, who, you, girls and boys, if you're 11 years old, no one should be taking the, like, well, how much money are you bringing in argument, because, you know, who cares? And at that, like, those programs should be equal, because at a certain point, like, it's not about revenue at all. It's about the fact that if you're like an 11-year-old girl playing pond hockey in Minnesota or an 11-year-old boy playing pond hockey in Minnesota, you should have access to the same opportunities.
But this is the bigger point. I mean, and let's not obsess on this individual sport, this one sport. I mean, the bigger point here is that in 2017, we are still talking about Title IX issues. The National Women's Law Center is still filing lawsuits against school districts to get girls equal opportunity on field times and equipment and locker rooms. I mean, I'll give you an example from my daughter's high school. Last fall, she's on the field hockey team. Their game ends. They want to go into their locker room to get their shit out of their lockers. There's a visiting JV football team changing for the game that's going to happen right afterward. So they're standing outside, so waiting for 60 10th grade boys to come out of the locker room. I mean, this is a much larger equity issue. And what the U.S. women's fight here suggests is that these issues are unresolved.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I played in high school. I went to an all-girls school, and yet you still had moments where if you were playing at someone else's school, you'd still have moments where I'm like, I go to an all-girls school and I still have to wait for boys to do something.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, I played lacrosse and field hockey because I went to an all-girls school, and that's what you do by law. But you'd go to, you know, the big co-ed public high school to play a game or something like that, and you're still waiting for like the freshman football team practice to finish. And you're just like, come on. This is ridiculous.
Right. I mean, the District of Columbia, the D.C. was sued for in an equal employment opportunity case because of this very issue about high school girls having to travel 45 minutes to practice where the boys get to walk next door and practice.
So
back to hockey.
Well, as I mentioned, let's end here. Like, as I mentioned at the top of the segment, it sort of seems like this is trending towards a deal getting made, and there might even be one by the time this podcast is released on Monday evening.
Especially since the men's team, there's been hints that they might be boycotting, which I think that would be the moment where they...
Right. I mean, we neglected to mention that. On Sunday night, an agent for a bunch of NHL players tweeted that the hockey team is considering boycotting their world championship, which starts in early May.
Right. So they kind of brilliantly use this moment of leverage, unfortunately a rare one for women's hockey, that the world championships are starting this week and that those world championships are in the United States. But I guess I'm curious to button this up with you guys' thoughts on if, as at least I assume is going to happen, a deal is made this week, how do these issues get carried forward? Because it seems like the most likely the most likely thing that'll happen is that a deal will get made and then we just won't talk about U.S. women's hockey again.
Which is really regrettable, because I think that that's the moment where, you know, I really want people to lift up the stories of women in sports when women in sports are not in peril. I think that's one of my favorite things about the Olympics, is that that's when you see someone like Katie Ledecky or Simone Biles, and they're just the best at what they do. They're the best for anything, for anyone. Like, Simone Biles is perhaps the greatest Olympic gymnast of all time. And I think that when these stories come up, I think it's worth noting that, you know, American women's hockey is a tremendous success story despite their league, despite, you know, USA Hockey. And it's worth paying attention to even when nothing is going wrong.
Sure. And I think the other thing we need to remember is that these big Olympic federations have a duty to support these sports. I mean, that's, you know, I'm not saying that that women's hockey is suddenly going to be on ESPN. We're not saying that these sports are going to suddenly generate audiences that are gigantic and that the athletes are going to get paid millions of dollars. The reality is that they're not right now. But the groups that have the authority, the ability, and the money to help support them and develop them over the next 10 or 20 or 30 years, those are the ones that we should be targeting and thinking about.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
When it launched in 2013, Fox Sports 1 was billed as the fun alternative to ESPN. They hired a couple of Canadian guys from the Canadian version of SportsCenter, which ends with an R-E instead of an E-R. And also Regis Philbin was involved. Remember that? He hosted a show called Crowd Goes Wild. The Regis and Canadians approach did not go super well. And in April 2015, a bit less than 2 years after the network went on the air, Fox hired Jamie Horowitz, the architect of ESPN's First Take. That is the show where Stephen A. Smith and Skip Bayless shout a lot about LeBron James not having the clutch gene. He was hired to remake the network, which he did in large part by hiring the likes of Skip Bayless, Colin Cowherd, and Jason Whitlock. In a bunch of different interviews, Horowitz said he wanted to model FS1 after Fox News, which seemed like a pretty obvious signal that he was going to strap some shoulder pads onto Sean Hannity. But circa March 2017, as our colleague Ben Mathis-Lilly wrote in a piece for Slate that is out this week, Fox Sports One is just as likely to air a bombastically left-wing opinion as a bombastically conservative one. Joining us now to discuss that piece is Ben Mathis-Lilly, who, despite lacking the clutch gene, has still managed to situate himself in front of a microphone. Hello, Ben.
Hi, guys. And yes, I'm not who you want up in the bottom of the ninth.
So Horowitz, you know, signs on to Fox. He tells many different publications that he wants to emulate Fox News. We've been working on this piece for a while, and I think we went in with the, like, not strawmanish idea that this was going to be like Roger Ailes circa 1996, and that he was going to try to create a conservative sports network. So what have you seen in the last, like, year or so, Ben, as you've watched it, and how is it different than what you thought that we would be getting?
Right. So, you know, that I think we took him at his word, you know, and he was quoted in I think two different publications, and he gave a speech at Williams College that got picked up, in which Jamie Horowitz said, "Yeah, we're gonna model this after Fox News. Fox News is proof that you can put opinion programming on the air, and you can kind of make your name with opinion programming if it's good enough, if it pops enough." And so, you know, we started watching the show, and it was at a, I think this is mid 2015, so, you know, the Trump campaign is just getting started when Horowitz makes that statement. And then obviously last year the campaign was on everyone's mind. And so I kind of thought, like, is this going to be the Trumpified, the Make America Great version of Sports Network? Is it going to be, you know, hours of programming every day about how football players used to be tougher and concussions, you know, the science behind concussions isn't quite settled, you know? I thought that was maybe what we were going to see, but that's not really what happened. There are several strong liberal voices on the show, and even the gentleman that Horowitz brought in from ESPN, Skip Bayless, Colin Cowherd, for example, are not always, you know, they're not down the line conservatives. They're not right wingers, and I think that has played out in some interesting ways in the last year.
The point that you make in the piece that I thought was dead on is that instead of modeling itself after Fox News, what Horowitz has wound up doing is modeling the network after sports talk radio. Do you think that was a realization that came later, or do you think that was the plan all along?
So, yeah, I think Horowitz, I talked to him for the piece, and you know, one thing he said is, you know, it wasn't always just supposed to be Fox News. And he said, you know, we also wanted to kind of model ourselves after Fox and FX. And that was his way of saying, you know, we wanted to be bold. You know, he didn't necessarily mean Fox News as in right wing. He meant it as in, you know, very strong, to put it one way, strong-willed personalities. And that is an influence that comes from sports talk radio as well. I mean, you've got, I think the person I mentioned in the piece is Jim Rome. His catchphrase is "Have a take and don't suck." So, you know, he's about being provocative, not necessarily always about being right or being justified or waiting until all the facts are in to make a decision. And that's kind of the ethos of a lot of sports radio is, you know, the game's over. Okay, who should be fired? You know, like let's sit around. Let's talk about, you know, maybe we didn't use enough cover two against this offense, but like this coach is an idiot. He's going to be fired. Like that's the way sports talk radio filters reality. And that's kind of the way Fox Sports One does as well, both in from right wing and from left wing. And then, you know, a lot of sports issues can't be broken down into those perspectives. But the one thing that is always happening on Fox Sports One is someone is decisively stating a very declarative opinion about
right.
whatever just happened.
I mean, but my thought is that perhaps the biggest hire wouldn't be necessarily Colin Cowherd. It would be someone like Gus Johnson, because Gus Johnson actually does sports. And I think that that's something you get to in the article, where you talk about how essentially they're building the entire plane out of First Take. Because Fox Sports One does not have – the reason why ESPN is successful is not because of First Take. It's because ESPN will pay someone $1 billion to show their games. ESPN is like, here you go, SEC. We'll show SEC on ESPN, SEC on ESPN, then on ABC. And so when you've got, I only watch Fox Sports One if it's related directly to a sporting event I want to watch, or it happens to be that Gus Johnson's doing the Big East tournament, because Gus Johnson will pass out at one of these times. I think, one of my favorite follows on Twitter, Richard Deitch, is always tweeting about how, Skip Bayless gets fewer viewers than random children's programming or old episodes of MASH. And so do you think that Fox Sports One can ever really start rivaling ESPN without actually getting ESPN-level sports?
Definitely not. You're totally right about that. It's all about the live events. And I think, without putting words in his mouth, I think Jamie Horowitz knows that. And he, when we talked, he kind of made a statement that more or less conceded that, in which he said, I think, our live events and our signature personalities are linked. And so what I speculate in the piece is that, he's kind of using this buzz that he's generating. I mean, he my article is kind of evidence of this. We wouldn't have been writing about Fox Sports One if they hadn't brought in these kind of controversial, buzzy, high profile personalities. We wouldn't have been writing, what's Fox Sports One's afternoon NASCAR coverage and, UFC analysis show? How's that doing? Slate's not going to write about that, which is, those are the kind of things that we're on in the afternoon and in the morning, before Horowitz came in. And so he's kind of raising the profile, within the media, in certain corners of social media, as you mentioned with, Deitch is SI's media reporter, and he's talking about Fox Sports One, even if it's to disparage it. It kind of puts them on the radar. But yes, absolutely, what they need to do is, once they're on the radar, they need to get in there with with a lot of money, and get the rights to, regular season NBA or, more playoff baseball. Like they absolutely, that's going to make them a competitor to ESPN. Right now, they're kind of an interesting, an interesting side story, not a competitor.
All right. So you mentioned the Trump campaign and how that coincided with the Horowitzification of Fox. The other thing, big event in sports and politics last year, was Colin Kaepernick and his kneeling during the national anthem. And that kind of made Fox more political, or made its political takes more of a part of the daily mix than they would have been otherwise. Otherwise, you might have just had Colin Cowherd talking about Jimmy Garoppolo for 3 hours a day. But just so folks have a sense, I want to play both sides of a conversation that you included in the piece, Ben. It's really interesting. So on the one side is Jason Whitlock, who has been – I don't even know if I want to characterize Whitlock's views, because they're very interesting. So let's listen to Whitlock on Kaepernick and Tom Brady and who is more righteous and true to himself.
A lot of people are beating up Tom Brady, Robert Kraft, and Belichick. They're friends with Trump. I know a lot of people, and I can name some people in the media, that were friends with Trump, played golf with Trump, mm-hmm. all before he was president.
Right.
And so, again, if you were friends with him then, you should be friends with him now, and people shouldn't be running from him. Again, I don't have remotely a problem with Tom Brady. To me, he's the anti-Colin Kaepernick. He has his politics, and he's making it clear. What Obama and them was down with, I wasn't with it. I'm going to hang here at Gillette Stadium. I'm down with Trump is with. We're still friends. I'm not going to back away from him, even though the media wants to put that pressure on. He's making a statement.
All right. And on that same panel was Chris Carter, former NFL wide receiver who expressed extremely different views.
You get to a certain status in life. I thought, well, you pick your friends and your friends don't pick you. So I don't know how Tom Brady, I don't care how he picks his friends. I don't care anything about his politics. But for me, it's important at this stage of my life, who my friends are and what they mean to me, and meaning by how they treat people, what they stand for. That's how I pick my friends. All right. Friends don't pick me. Now, I have associations. I have business relationships. Now, those are different, but they say that they're friends. Me, I pick my friends based on things that we might have in common and long term in life that we might have in common. So that's the only difference between myself and Tom Brady.
Okay, so yeah, so those two opinions kind of reflect what FS1 has become. You have Whitlock, who that is the classic hot take, you know, bringing Brady and Kaepernick together, you know, kind of putting them into opposition with each other, which they aren't really. You know, Colin Kaepernick doesn't comment on Tom Brady, and Tom Brady doesn't comment on Colin Kaepernick. And, you know, kind of making what I think is a kind of tendentious point about Brady standing up for himself in a way that Kaepernick didn't. Because I think, you know, for better or worse, whatever you think of Kaepernick, I mean, he stood up for himself. He defended his views. You know, he talked to anyone who wanted to talk to him about it, and he spent lots of time answering questions. But then on the other hand, and you know, this is what was surprising to me, you have Chris Carter, who, you know, I don't know much about Chris Carter's politics as a whole, but he's talking about Brady and making, I think, it's a subtle point, especially by television standards, which is that, you know, who your friends are reflects who you are, and their values reflect your values. And he's kind of implying, without actually being too provocative about it or inflammatory, he's kind of making the point that, well, you know, Brady is representing Trump's values, whether he wants to say he is or not, by, you know, publicly avowing their friendship and putting the Trump hat in his locker. And so, you know, I those are two poles of the question. And you are going to see both of those kind of viewpoints represented on Fox News, or excuse me, on Fox Sports One. A lot of people on FS1 defended Kaepernick. Shannon Sharp, who is Skip Bayless's partner on the show Undisputed, was very, very, I think, eloquent in defending Kaepernick's protest and just talking about the kind of the purpose of protests more generally, and the conditions in America that may have led Kaepernick to do what he did, in a way that absolutely I wasn't expecting on, you know, any sports talk, much less the one that was supposed to be modeled after, you know, Fox News.
And I think the conclusion that we can draw here is that you're not going to draw an audience from what you describe as the reasonable center. So Fox Sports One ends up being more like CNN. And what's more important is
more like CNN, in that you just like put a panel of people with the most extreme possible views.
Correct.
And instead of trying to come to a consensus, just have them.
You just put Van Jones and Jeffrey Lord in a room and go nuts.
Right. And so it's not the conclusions that they make or the rightness of their takes, but the mere fact of them. Because what you want in sports, and I think Jamie Horowitz obviously is playing on this, is you want to foster fan division and antagonism. You know, Skip Bayless knows to some extent that what he's saying is bullshit, but he also knows that the public is dumb enough to want to hear him say that bullshit.
Right.
And I think the second point that I think is worth making here is that all of us, including Richard Deitch of Sports Illustrated, you know, all of us who analyze this stuff, maybe are missing the bigger point, which is that ratings don't matter quite as much in the social media age. Yeah, you need people to tune in so that you can charge money for commercials. But if the long game for Jamie Horowitz and Fox is to create a network that people are aware of because of all the takes, and then at some point you're able to pry away the NBA or another NFL game onto your cable network, then you've got something that has substance.
Right. And I think that it's a really good point that it's not necessarily right-wing takes. It's as what Deadspin calls speak for yourself, all takes matter. And that it just all takes all the time. And so – and I think that you make a really good point that I think we're all kind of playing into that. You know, when Jason Whitlock goes on some long rant about how LeBron James is a social justice warrior, and I share it and add in the take, this is the stupidest thing I have ever seen in my entire life, Jason Whitlock somewhere is, I don't know, getting another $5. And I think that that's the point, I guess, is to just infuriate and annoy. And so that, I mean, it basically is kind of like if you somehow combined what Rush Limbaugh does with what Air America tried to do and then turned it into a sports channel.
Right. I mean, because none of these guys is Sean Hannity, right? There's no dangerous convictions here.
But Ben, I think that a conservative sports network, like if Roger Ailes had been a sports fan, I do think that there actually would be a market for that. And I think that, you know, Jamie Horowitz is probably smart for not trying to cater exclusively to that audience. But like when Clay Travis, whose stuff is licensed by Fox, and he's the most like, you know, he talks about black privilege and he is the most like ridiculously conservative personality in there.
Whoa. He says that he voted for Hillary Clinton, so it's okay. He wanted GW law and he could only practice law on the Virgin Islands. So let's just, you know, let's keep our takes down.
Stipulate all of that stipulated. But, you know, like didn't Clay Travis say on Twitter recently that he bet that if Fox gave him his own show, he would be able to beat Skip Bayless in the ratings? I actually totally believe that that's true.
Yeah,
I think and, you know, I think what Clay Travis is, he's in the politically incorrect space, you know, and as people have talked about with Trump, you know, Trump's politics are not necessarily right wing down the line. But what he does better than anyone in American history, unfortunately, is just capture this idea that people are upset that society has gotten too politically correct. And that's kind of the same vein that Clay Travis plays. And he's very successful. He has a very, very loyal following, as far as I can tell, on his podcast, his Twitter account, his website. What he does is he services that exact kind of reaction to it's people who are upset that ESPN gave Caitlyn Jenner the Arthur Ashe Courage Award. And there are a lot of those people.
Really mentioned the background here that like if you look at right wing media, people are obsessed with the idea that ESPN is liberal and like putting progressive views down all of our throats.
Yeah, I think Ben Sasse, the senator from Nebraska, has actually tweeted about that. It's definitely an idea that has a lot of currency on right wing sites that ESPN is trying to, you know, in cahoots with the rest of the liberal elite, indoctrinate us into believing that you know Caitlyn Jenner is okay or
Colin Kaepernick's right.
That Colin Kaepernick's right, that police officers are bad because they aired Chris Paul, LeBron, and Carmelo, you know, doing a Black Lives Matter protest at the beginning of the ESPYs. You know, that because ESPN documents these things, that ESPN is trying to indoctrinate us, and there is a significant backlash, you know, big enough to support, you know, Clay Travis and kind of lift that tide of that kind of like right-wing sports take environment.
Though I would say that I think that really goes to ESPN's genius, that you could get people so angry about an invented award show that in which the awards don't really matter or exist.
All awards matter, Jane. All awards matter.
Right, you know, the controversy that the Arthur Ashe, the ESPYs award didn't go to someone else that year,
next year it'll go to Clay Travis. All right. All right, Ben, thank you for joining us, and I want you to stick around.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when he did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the time in the show where we usually do Afterballs. And Afterballs will be back. Don't fret. But we're in our experimental phase of the podcast. We're sort of like trying to figure things out here.
We're also kind of busy over the weekend.
Well, speak for yourself. I mean, all takes matter. So I put out a survey on Twitter and our Facebook page asking folks who is the weirdest coach in history of any sport and why. And I did this because I knew Jane was going to be on the show and I knew that the number one answer would be Jim Harbaugh. And I was in fact vindicated. Jim Harbaugh came on top. So we're going to do this in two parts. First will be discussion of Jim Harbaugh and his strangeness. The second will be Family Feud style, where I'll ask you guys to guess who the other finishers and the top weirdest coach in history sweepstakes were. Let's start with you, Ben, since you're not in the studio with us and can't revel in our camaraderie. I want you to feel included. What is your favorite episode of Jim Harbaugh weirdness, or how would you characterize his weirdness?
Yeah, I think the one that immediately comes to mind is very timely, which is that Jim Harbaugh turns out to be on some sort of advisory board for the Legal Services Corporation, which is funded by the government and provides legal services to defendants who cannot afford them. And in fact, tweeted recently when Donald Trump's budget proposal leaked, Harbaugh tweeted angrily about the proposed cuts to the Legal Services Corporation. And I have to say, I've been following Harbaugh's work for the last several years. And that was really unexpected.
Knew about the khaki pants.
Yeah, exactly.
Knew about sleeping over at recruits' houses. Knew about climbing trees. Did not know about being on the board of Legal Services Corporation.
Right.
Yeah. And there's this interview with him in Politico. And, you know, he's still a football coach. You know, he knows he's representing. He has a lot of fans on both sides of the aisle, so he's very careful to say it's a bipartisan issue, but he really truly does. You can tell in this Politico interview, you know, he knows his stuff. He actually explains the issues, I thought, pretty well.
And I think that that's the thing with Harbaugh, you know, as someone else who's been following Harbaugh's work extremely closely, like, you know, deadhead level closely. I think that it's a performative weirdness. It's a very much like Jim Harbaugh in real life. If you were to have a conversation with him in an actual environment, you would probably come up, you know, be like, okay, he's kind of intense, but he's not like talking to himself weird. And I think that very much of like a lot of the things that seem super weird are mostly because he knows people will talk about them. Like, he knows that climbing a tree at a recruit's house, or sleeping over, or dancing with Migos, or showing up in a music video or something like that, that's all stuff that's going to, you know, to someone who's like 30, that's super weird. To someone who's 17, that's awesome. You know, and I think that that's something that
you're marketing to his audience.
Exactly.
Right?
And so his audience is not necessarily us. His audience is not people who already think that college football is weird in a lot of ways, because it is weird. His audience is like 17-year-old boys who also want to hang out with someone who is, you know, proven in the NFL and will eat, sleep, and breathe football, which is why I think that in a weird way, he's very similar to Nick Saban. Nick Saban, who I think is very odd, mostly because I don't think anyone should eat that many little snack cakes and iceberg lettuce. What? That's so weird.
All right. Here's some next level shit for you, Ben. What if Harbaugh is performing weirdness, but actually deep down, the fact that he does that is incredibly weird? Like, he thinks that he's pretending to be weird, but he's in fact deeply, deeply weird. Convincing?
I'm willing to buy that. I actually have, this is, Josh, you sent me to a camp in Paramus, New Jersey, to observe Harbaugh in person for a story that
you sent me to a camp. Yes, I did.
For a story that in fact got swallowed by working on this Fox Sports piece. And it's funny what Jane was saying. I got to see that exactly up close. So I showed up to this. It's a day long camp for high school football players, ranging from top level D1 prospects to some of these kids were like 4'10" incoming freshmen. So, you know, 500 kids at this camp, really just like a sports camp like you'd see anywhere in the country in the summer. And so I got to sit next to Harbaugh and kind of follow him around for the day. And he really, there is absolutely a switch. You know, when the first time I saw him, he's sitting in a room with all the other coaches who are running the camp, and they're going over just the extremely banal details of running a football camp. You know, okay, the running backs group is going to go here. Hey, who has the cones? You know, like, okay, Frank has the cones, you know, like all that stuff. And yes, he's carrying out those kind of duties in a way that no one would find exceptional. But then he gets out into the gym. We walk over to the gym, where all the kids are. And the kids are excited, because not only Harbaugh was there, but, his brother showed up, Pat Narduzzi, the Pitt coach, was there. There was like a lot of top college head coaches. Like, this was a big deal for these kids. A couple of the other coaches get up and give kind of very football rah-rah speeches. You know, we're going to go out there and work hard because hard work is how you win games, blah, blah, blah. And Harbaugh, who up to that point, you wouldn't have been able to pick out as like the most famous or the most weird coach. Then Harbaugh takes the mic and just, you know, completely transforms and gives this, like, has everyone stand, you know, standing by the end of his talk, talking. I think he was describing a racehorse, and he got really into detail about how much his heart beats like a racehorse, like that's in the gates for the Kentucky Derby, and his hair stands up, and that's how he feels every time he gets to coach or play football, and that's how he feels right now, and that's how you should feel. And like, I was ready to, you know, go out and just,
Jane
and
is
just
almost
do some drills.
Jane's fanning herself right now.
and yeah, like it's absolutely like, you know, and I think he has a sense of humor, and I think he knows that like people are going to get a kick out of this. But yeah, at the same time, like the fact that his mind could even go there to think of like, let me describe a racehorse's heart to these 16-year-old kids
on
when we're
basics.
About to like go about to do like non-contact football drills in New Jersey, like the 30th camp I've been doing, you know, like. Yeah. It is truly exceptional and weird that he can get that excited about it.
So, so he's either method actor or performance artist.
It's
Marlon Brando or Miranda July. Right.
Either way, greatest performances of our time. And I think that that's really critical, because I think that that is, you know, I used to think that like if you had to hang out with performative Jim Harbaugh all the time, like I don't know how he's married, I don't know how his children deal with him, but then you realize that like, okay, if he's an actual person a lot of the time, but then he gets on Twitter and tries to start shit with Paul Feinbaum, which I recommend highly all the time, that is tolerable. And then I think that that links to we were talking about kind of, you know, the weirdest coaches, and I read
Can I use that as a transition to phase two?
Yes, definitely.
Here's phase two. Is I've got a list of other folks who people nominated. So Harbaugh is number one. I've got a list of about 10 dudes here. And you guys can play the...
All dudes?
You can play... It's all dudes. You can play the hang-up feud in any way that you want.
Jane, no peeking at Josh's
I'm not
screen,
peeking. I actually cannot see.
So last week, Jeopardy. This week, Family Feud.
Right. So you can play it in one of two ways. You can say who you think the weirdest coach is if you want to lose. Or if you want to try to win the game, you could think of who the hang-up audience would identify as the weirdest coach. All right. Back to the Coaston family.
Okay.
Okay. So I'll try and play it in two ways. So I think someone on that list would probably be Pete Carroll. And I think that that would mostly come from the 9/11 truth ring. But I think my personal choice, and I think this is linked
you to... Can't, no, you get one true. You can't like...
I could play that however I want.
One.
As long as I get two also.
Yes. Everyone gets two now.
This
we
is
all
the
hang
up feud. There are different rules. Go ahead, Jane. Don't listen to Stefan.
So I think that I was reading a recent article that was talking about the fact that Bobby Knight talked about how he hoped everyone related with Indiana when he was there was dead or dying. And I think secretly Bobby Knight is actually one of the weirdest coaches, because that is who he actually is. And it turns out he was just a sociopath this whole time. And, you know, you read a great article where Indiana reporter, I think from the Indianapolis Star, was interviewing Dan Dockich and just being like, this is the first time when Dan Dockich, who played for Bobby Knight, realized like, oh, he is a terrible human being. I mean, he's been a terrible human being for a really long time. But like the fact that he is – no one wants to be around Bobby Knight. People do not like – I do not want to be around Bobby Knight. ESPN didn't want to be around Bobby Knight. Like
Donald Trump wanted to be around Bobby Knight.
I don't think that he wants to be around.
Did you pick someone, by the way?
She did. She picked.
I picked Bobby Knight.
You picked Bobby Knight. Okay.
Bobby Knight is the number two answer on the board
behind
Jim Harbaugh. Pete Carroll. What one person put Pete Carroll? Which I guess we don't give you a strike for that if one person did. And their answer for why was, because he is a 9/11 truther and does not believe Stevie Wonder is blind.
So, two for two.
Is that true, the second part?
I don't know, but somebody said it, so I'm going to just repeat it. That's the journalistic standard on
that
show.
That is low-key the biggest internet rumor ever. Is that
Stevie Wonder. I love the rumor. Yeah,
oh, it's fantastic.
Love the rumor.
Yeah.
All right. Stefan Fatsis for the block. I'm gonna mix my game shows here.
Well. Yeah, I'm thinking like a hang up and listener. So I'm going to rule out the managers, the crazy people from my long ago childhood, the Billy Martins, the Woody Hayeses. They were all genuinely crazy. So
Stefan
I'm going to go with
buying time. I like it.
Bill Belichick.
All right, let me go into my spreadsheet. Definitely not one of the top answers for sure. All right, two people said Bill Belichick. Why? sociopath was one reason. Yeah. And the second was his press conferences are the longest running performance art pieces in history, which fair point. Mm-hmm. All right. So not the best performance, Stefan, but this is the first.
Was that did I get a
sure.
Or is it on the board?
I mean, it's not one of the top 10. It's not one of the top 10 answers, but I don't want you to feel bad about yourself. So there you go. All right. Ben Mathis-Lilly, who do you got?
I would like to point out that Bill Belichick was, I think, weirdly named out of nowhere in a New Jersey divorce lawsuit, which I think, you know, as the other man, and considering his kind of like wardrobe and general meaner, mm-hmm. I think.
Does he or does he not believe Stevie Wonder is blind?
Bill Belichick's sexy temptress. Okay. for the list, I think that... I think that a very solid choice, one that our listeners would have thought about, would be Les Miles, and then for my own choice,
Ding!
in a similar
just playing to Josh too,
in a similar vein, I'm going to go with, and this is maybe just the moment, you know, everything else he does is pretty weird too, but the fact that Bo Pelini, hard-nosed football coach, led Nebraska onto the field while holding his beloved cat above his head, mm-hmm. Out of the tunnel. I'm looking at the picture right now, like charging out of the tunnel, holding a cat.
That dude is weird. Yeah.
That's weird. Yeah. So that's going to be that's my choice.
All right. So Les Miles was definitely one of the top 10 on the board. The answers from the listeners were he eats grass, eating grass, and complete and utter disregard for clock management.
Right. So doesn't really know the rules of football despite being a pretty good football coach for like 40 years.
I would say though that I feel as if like Les Miles' weirdness in like 2008 and Les Miles' weirdness last year are two completely different things because he was not the Mad Hatter last year. His weirdness last year was just being like, huh, the forward pass. I'm not into it. Like, so that's weird.
So it was five different people submitted Les Miles. And I think this is actually a good breakdown of like the different sections of Les Miles' brain. 3/5 is devoted to eating grass. 1/5 is clock management. How does that work? And the other 1/5 is just blank. No, they didn't submit an answer. All right. So here are the ones that you guys did not name. Bobby Valentine.
Bobby Valentine.
He wore the mustache, the Groucho glasses, and snuck back into the dugout after getting ejected. Bobby Valentine, number 3. Number 4, and I was surprised and proud of the listeners for this selection, Jerry Glanville.
Jerry Glanville.
Former Falcons coach, dressed in all black. The reasons, and maybe I didn't do like a lot of security quote unquote for the survey. So maybe it was just the same person over and over again who was a big fan of Jerry Glanville, but leaving tickets at every game for Elvis.
Solid.
Also the way he dressed, the way he spoke, his weird game plans, and then all his strategic eccentricities, run and gun, his boorish media personality that makes Rex Ryan look meek. It's kind of surprising he didn't resurface as an XFL coach.
True.
All right, I'm going to run through the rest quickly. Yogi Berra, Rex Ryan, Diego Maradona, Mike Leach, Phil Jackson, Jerry Tarkanian, and Paul Westhead. And then I wanted to give a shout out to the people that mentioned fictional coaches.
Dennis Hopper and Hoosiers was on my list.
My favorite one was Air Bud. Surely there is an Air Bud movie where a wizened Air Bud coached his former team to glory, right? And then parentheses, I've never seen any Air Bud movies.
I really think the Rex Ryan choice, I think that's probably where I should have gone. I think that anyone who has a tattoo of their wife wearing the jersey of a player who no longer plays for them, that's weird. Like that's, for one thing, that seems short-sighted and weird.
All right. The two that I had not heard of that are off the board, but I totally enjoyed learning about were Mirko Slomka, the coach of the German soccer club Hanover, who sent his players a 128-question questionnaire with questions asking about their sexual interests. And his explanation was, with this test, I know how I can best reach each player. And the final one was Bill Shanahan, a debate coach at Fort Hays State University, who during an argument with another debate coach, this is according to the Chronicle for Higher Education, dropped his pants in an extended argument, and you can watch this on YouTube. That's a weird-ass coach.
That's weird.
Coach.
Weird also, code. Weird, I weird just, ass.
Also a weird debate tactic.
I wanted to pop in to note that Bobby Valentine did later become the safety director of Stamford, Connecticut. We're making it a very solid choice for this.
That is true. All right, Ben, thank you very much for joining us and playing the Hang Up feud. Jane, thank you for being here and for also playing the Hang Up feud. And Stefan.
I don't deserve any thanks.
You're the best, as always. We'd love your feedback on what we talked about today. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. We'll also gather links to the stories we discussed at slate.com/hangup. Subscribe in iTunes. You can find us at itunes.com/slatepodcasts. When you're there, leave us a comment and a rating. Become a fan of Hang Up and Listen on Facebook at facebook.com/hangupandlisten. And if you're looking for a recommendation for another sports podcast, there's one from the Panoply Network called Dirty Tackle. It's a soccer podcast. It's part of the Panoply Pilot Project, where listeners can help decide which series get green lit. You can check it out at panoply.fm/panoplypilots. Our intern is Adam Willis. Our producer is Patrick Fort. The executive producer of Slate's podcast is Steve Lichtai. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of Panoply. Hang Up and Listen as part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster at itunes.com/panoply. Remember Zelmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.